So we're going to actually be in the book of Judges. We're going to start in chapter 13, and my hope here is to teach the story, the life of Samson in two parts. So the unique thing about Samson is that we see his entire life. We see from before he was born. We see the rise, we see the fall, we see the fallout, and we see his death as well, and how God used him. I intend to look at the beginnings of his life in this study, and I hope to be able to do another study on the ends of his life, which will be the last two chapters. And I'm hoping and thinking that this will be something that I'll deliver on a Sunday at Believer City Church here in the next month or two. So that's my plan here. One thing to recognize about Samson, just historically speaking, in Judges 13, he lived and operated in this transitional time between Israel's spirit-led conquering and entrance into the promised land. And that was in the book of Joshua. And then he's kind of bookended there. And then also between the time of the kings of Israel, which were documented in the first few books of Samuel. This was a time when God's people were governed by a series of individuals that we understand as judges, okay? And we'll talk a little bit about what that meant to be a judge, what it looked like. But that lasted for about 350 years. Just kind of a background on that as well, of what was going on in the book of Judges. Israel had kind of lost its way, right? It had lost its next critical link in its move forward in godly leadership. Moses was the great leader, and he ushered the people of Israel out, right? Joshua helped lead the people of Israel in to the promised land. So Moses helped them come out of Egypt. Joshua, 40 years later, helps them come into the promised land. But Joshua didn't appoint a leader after him to take over for the whole nation. And they were really in a critical place at this point in time in the book of Judges that really is kind of bizarre. If you've read it and you're familiar with it, there's a lot of really strange things that happen. And maybe this is a kind of a nice little lead up to it. Samson is really a kind of a strange story. He's a strange character. In A strange character is not a good thing to be in a time when your nation needs to hear from God more intensely than they ever had, because they need leaders. And I would suggest to you that our churches, Christianity needs leaders today, maybe more so than ever in our own period of time, our own recent history. Samson, if you can sum him up in one word, would be paradox. What's a paradox? Yeah, that's an easy way to remember it. It contradicts itself. There's two parts to it, and they seem to be mutually exclusive, and yet they exist at the same. That's Samson in a nutshell. That's Samson in a nutshell. He has great beginnings, but he blows it all up, right? He has great strength from God. But personally, he's a very weak person. He messes up in huge ways. And yet, somehow inexplicably, God still uses him. His life can be viewed really as a paradox, paradox in the fact that it's a cautionary tale, and at the same time, it's a picture of God's enduring grace. And so, that's kind of the title of this. I call it a cautionary paradox. You could take this as a warning, or you could take this as encouragement. And it may be both of those things to you at different times in your life, even. Okay. There's really a lot here. My fear is that I'm not going to be able to fit it all in 45 minutes, but I'm going to do my best. There's a lot of lessons that we can take from this. a few of them to kind of guide our evening tonight. Beginnings are important. How you begin is important, but biblically, how you finish is critical. It is key. It's easy to begin things. I have a student, I work in special education, I have a student, and she begins all sorts of projects. And she's a perfectionist, she is a nitpicker and stuff like that. So much so that I think she almost like puts herself to sleep because she'll just kind of crash out. I can't get her to finish anything, right? She wants it all to be perfect. Then there's people who've got great talent and great ability, and they finish, they start things, but they just can't wrap it up, right? The process is the outcome. Maybe you've heard that idea, and that is true. I believe that idea that there's a lesson to be learned in how we do things. And as Christians, how we do things is just as important as what we do, right? These are important lessons. Another one is that when we plant unrighteously, we're going to reap unrighteously. There's a biblical lesson of sowing and reaping, you know, and we recognize this just from gardening. You plant tomato seeds, you don't expect to get strawberries, you know. And it's kind of like, well, duh. But I challenge you to think about that. Do we ever do that in our own Christian lives where we're just like, well, I'm going to be kind of half-baked about this. But then we're surprised when it doesn't turn out perfectly at the end. Or it was like, wait a second, this didn't, oh, well, I didn't really put everything I had into it. We didn't sow righteously, and so we only reap partially. Samson is a good picture of that. And then the last one that I think helps to kind of overarch all of these lessons here too is that judgment and forgiveness are not mutually exclusive. What do I mean by that? God can forgive all the sinful activities that we do, but there's a dangerous and yet all too common misunderstanding that he'll also allow us to escape the consequences of those actions as well. So I've done a lot of different things in ministry over the years. One of them was jail chaplaincy. I didn't want to be a jail chaplain. I didn't want to go and teach in the jails. When our pastor said, hey, we're going to start a Bible study in the jail, in my head and in my heart, and I think even in my lips, I'm just like, why in the world would we want to do that? You know, I'm just like, what the heck? And then I started going in and doing that because it's like, well, I'm going to do it because this is what we do and I want to be a part of it. And I absolutely fell in love with it. There was something about it. God showed up there, and I'm addicted to him. And so I wanted to be where he was, and he was there. And I heard this message really communicated very clearly, where it's like, well, you know, I did these things, but it's like, you know, God's going to forgive me, and everything's going to be okay. God's going to forgive you. He can forgive you. But okay may not look like what you're thinking, you know. Okay may be something completely different and new. Well, I want it to go back the way that it was. That's okay. I can tell you one thing. It'll never go back to the way that it was. It's only going forward, right? When we read and learn from the failures of Samson, we're going to see that there's more there than in the victories that he wins. I would suggest to you as well that each of his victories actually at the same time is also a failure. There are failures and things where he is partially obedient that only leads to a partial completion of what God intended to do in his life. And I would suggest to you that the greatest, maybe biggest cautionary tale is the life of Samson is that he started a great work. He was really promising, but he was unable to finish it fully. So verse 1, and let's read a little bit here. In verse 1 of chapter 13 of Judges. Again, the children of Israel did evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord delivered them into the hand of the Philistines for 40 years. Now there was a certain man from Zorah of the family of the Danites whose name was Manoah, and his wife was barren, and he had no children. had no children. And the angel of the Lord appeared to the woman and said to her, "Indeed, now you are barren and have become born no children, but you shall conceive and bear a son. Now therefore, please be careful not to drink wine or similar drink, not to eat anything unclean, for behold, you shall conceive and bear a son, and no razor shall come upon his head, for the child shall be a Nazarite to God from the womb, and he shall begin to deliver Israel out of the hand of the Philistines." So this is kind of an interesting, unique announcement, right? We see maybe even a parallel, like right now in our Christmas time, where we have this miraculous birth being announced. There are numerous parallels that can be drawn in the life of Samson to Jesus. And as we go through this, you may see those. They're definitely there. It's not something I'm going to dwell a lot on here tonight. But one of the things to recognize, verse 1, Israel did evil, and the Lord delivered them to the Philistines. This is the way it was in the book of Judges. God's people were just following the same circles and cycles of behavior. They would fall into sin and start worshiping false gods. They leave the one true God who had led them all of their lives, which would then inevitably lead them into slavery. And they would suffer in that until they kind of came to their senses, and then they would come to repentance and they'd cry out, and he would send a judge to redeem them, right? And then they would return and they'd be restored for a period of time until the next time that they forgot. And then the whole cycle would start over and over again. And this is about the 12th lap in the book of Judges that Israel has done of that cycle. He's going through this. And we've seen 11 other judges up to the point of Samson. That oftentimes happened in just certain areas or maybe with certain tribes. But one thing, again, that kind of makes this unique is that we see all of Samson's life story from birth until death. And here we look in verse 3, we see it where it is announced that the angel of the Lord is saying, you're going to give birth. You've been completely incapable. It's not something that's going to happen to you. It hasn't happened to you. You've not been able to get pregnant. But take hope. This is going to happen. And the angel of the Lord here that we see, this is not just any angel. Okay, the phrasing of that is kind of specific. Capital letters in the word Lord, we see that this is a theophany. And that's a big word for a pre-incarnate visitation of Jesus. That's what we as Christians understand. Theophany can be described as any time that God comes in human form, and we recognize this was Jesus coming down for a specific purpose to meet Manoah and his wife for this special mission of saying, I have a son who's going to be born to you, and he has a special place. He has a special purpose that he's going to exist for. And part of it was in the fact that he was going to be set apart. He was going to be special and have a Nazarite vow. That word Nazarite literally means consecrated. Consecrated simply means to be separated, to be devoted, to be special. At home, I have a consecrated coffee cup. I only drink coffee from this one cup, right? Nothing else goes into this coffee cup. It is only coffee. It's not tea. It's not just water. It's not, heaven forbid, you put juice or something in it. It's just coffee, right? Special purpose. That was supposed to be Samson. One thing, right? And the signs of this Nazarite vow was one that there would be an avoidance of alcohol and even any fruit of the vine. So grapes, raisins, all that's out. Wine is right out. Mom's not even supposed to be anywhere near wine or grapes while she's pregnant with Samson. That's how consecrated he's supposed to be. The second part was he's not supposed to touch anything that's dead, right? So, you know, if any of you are hunters out there, it's like Samson wanted to go hunting, you better bring a friend because he's not going to be getting his hands dirty gutting anything, right? And then the last one here, his hair remains uncut, okay? That was more than just a way to save some money from the barber, right? Long hair back in the day was considered a sign of shame. It was to be kind of socially even looked upon as an outcast. I used to have long hair down to the middle of my back. So, I mean, I've been there and done. You get some strange looks sometimes too. But as Christians, we recognize this, like, if I'm living my life in a way that people recognize it, I'm opening myself for ridicule, right? That's kind of the parallel I think we can understand. And there's no out for this guy. A Nazarite vow could be taken for a week, a month, a few months, a year. He's Nazarite from the womb throughout his entire life. There was no escape, okay? So this is going to be his life, and this is the announcement. Verse 6 says, "The woman came and told her husband, saying, 'A man of God came to me, and his countenance was like the countenance of an angel of God. Very awesome, but I did not ask him where he was from. He did not tell me. He said, "Behold, you shall conceive and bear a son. Now drink no wine or similar drink, nor eat anything unclean, for the child shall be Nazarite to God from the womb to the day of his death." And Manoah prayed to the Lord and said, "Oh, my Lord, please let the man of God whom you sent come to us again and teach us what we shall do for the child who will be born." And God listened to the voice of Manoah, and the angel of God came to the woman again, and she was sitting in the field, but Manoah, her husband, was not with her. Verse 10, "Then the woman ran in haste and told her husband and said to him, 'Look, the man who came to me the other day has just now appeared to me.' So Manoah arose and followed his wife. And when he came to the man, he said to him, 'Are you the man who spoke to this woman?' And he said, 'I am.'" Now remember, that's in verse 11. This is a theophany. This is what we understand as the pre-incarnate Jesus Christ meeting with Manoah and his wife. And he says, "Who are you?" And he says, "I am." That's an interesting answer, because if you're familiar with the Old Testament at all, you recognize that "I am" was the name that the burning bush gave to Moses when he said, "Who are you, Lord?" He says, "I am that I am." He said, "That's what my name is." And so we see this picture of this is, he's meeting face to face with God here. This is going to be a pretty special person, because God doesn't just come down out of heaven to meet with just about anybody, right? So we see these great beginnings starting. Manoah said, "Now let your words come to pass. What will be the boy's rule of life and his work?" So the angel said to the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, "Of all the things that I said to the woman, let her be careful. She may not eat anything that comes from the vine, nor may she drink wine or similar drink, or eat anything unclean. All that I commanded her, let her observe." Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, "Please let us detain you, and we will prepare a young goat for you." We're going to have a party, basically. We're going to celebrate. Verse 16, "And the angel of the Lord said to Manoah, 'Though you detain me, I will not eat your food. But if you offer a burnt offering, you must offer it to the Lord.' For Manoah did not know he was the angel of the Lord. Then Manoah said to the angel of the Lord, 'What is your name, that when your words come to pass, we may honor you?' And the angel of the Lord said to him, 'Why do you ask my name, seeing it is wonderful?'" Isaiah 9:6 explains to us further who this angel of the Lord is by his taking and assuming the name Wonderful for himself, because Isaiah 9:6, maybe you've heard it read recently. It says, "For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, the Mighty God, the Everlasting Father, the Prince of Peace. So we see these wonderful beginnings here. And Manoah takes this young goat. That's just how they partied back in the day. He takes this young goat with the grain offering. They offer it upon the rock to the Lord. And he did a wondrous thing while Manoah and his wife looked on. It happened as the flame went up toward heaven from the altar, the angel of the Lord ascended in the ground, ascended in the flame of the altar. When Manoah and his wife saw this, they fell on their faces to the ground. When the angel of the Lord appeared no more to Manoah and his wife, then Manoah knew that he was the angel of the Lord. And Manoah said to his wife, "We shall surely die because we have seen God." So we get this idea, the theophany, the meeting face to face with God, but it's just now dawning on Manoah. It's like, wait a second. This was God face to face in the flesh. We saw this. This was God. You have to recognize in the day they understood this, that to see God face to face meant you would die, right? You couldn't do it. Moses said, "Let me see your face." And God says, "You can't look on my face without dying. I'll let you look at my back." And just that left him glowing. When he came down, he was just like, whoa, he had this aura around him. Manoah kind of freaks out here. And he's like, "We're going to die. We're going to die." And his wife, I get the, you know, if I had the video, I think she'd be like, you know, slap him upside. It's like, come on, wait a second. She has to speak some sense into his life. And says in verse 23, "If the Lord had desired to kill us, he would not have accepted this burnt offering and grain offerings, nor would he have shown us all these things, nor would he have told us such things as these at this time." He said, "We're going to have a kid, Manoah. He's not going to kill us." It's like, snap out of it. So the woman bore a son and called his name Samson, and the child grew, and the Lord blessed him. And the Spirit of the Lord began to move upon him at Manoah Dan between Zorah and Eshtaol. So we see the elements of these great beginnings. We see God showing up in person to announce a promised child to a barren woman, essentially a miraculous birth. This child's life was going to be set apart for God, set apart for God's purpose, set apart by God's power. And we see that the spirit of blessing is moving on this child, Samson. He's been described in the book of Judges as being the judge with the most opportunity for success, more so than any of the other judges that were contemporary at that time. And yet, despite all of the great beginnings, things don't continue to look so promising. And if you are familiar with the story of Samson, you're like, yeah, this isn't going to end well, because it isn't going to end well, right? Verse 1 of chapter 14. "Now Samson went down to Timnah and saw a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines." The Philistines are the people that he's supposed to be delivering them from, right? It's kind of like going down to the enemy, right? "He went up and told his father and mother, saying, 'I've seen a woman in Timnah of the daughters of the Philistines. Now, therefore, go and get her for me as a wife.'" Samson is going to the wrong place, and he's looking for the wrong thing here. One of the reasons why Samson was unable to finish this great thing that was started in him is because he continues to struggle with compromise in his life. Okay. A few things about the Philistines. They're a seafaring people. They came kind of from the Aegean area around Greece. But they're characterized by their worldliness and being just amazing warmongers. They could wage war like no other. They had a distinct advantage compared to the Israelites in the fact that they had mastered iron weapons while the Israelites were still stuck in the Bronze Age. So it's like a bronze weapon is not going to be any match to iron weapons. And so there was some legitimate fear on the Israelite side for what they were facing with the Philistines, because they had a distinct way of beating them all the time, right? These guys worshipped a fish god named Dagon, who was part fish, part man. One of the things that went on in the worship was weeks-long drunken orgies and celebrations unto this fish god Dagon. So these were kind of a mean and nasty people. They were not somebody to mess around with. But that's what we see Samson doing. He's got this great call on his life, but he's not taking it seriously. And so he literally starts going and searching around, and he's attracted to the enemy. His father and his mother said to him, "Is there no woman among the daughters of your brethren or among my people that you must go and get a wife from the uncircumcised Philistines?" And Samson said to her, said to his father, "Get her for me, for she pleases me well." Not only is he open to compromise, but he also is closed to godly counsel. He's rejecting the godly counsel of his parents. His parents resisted Samson and warned him, but he wasn't having it. "She pleases me well" simply means she's good looking. "I like her because she's hot, Dad. Go get her for me." Right? Pretty shallow guy. But his father and mother, verse 4, did not know that it was of the Lord, that he was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines, for at that time the Philistines had dominion over Israel. This is an important verse, because at this verse, there's a dangerous assumption that we can make. That because, as it says here, that the Lord was seeking an occasion to move against the Philistines, you might fall into the trap of believing that this was an endorsement of God's of Samson's sinful desires and actions. That's like, well, he's going off and he's going and following his flesh. He's going after the enemy in a way that he shouldn't be, but God was going to use it. Be careful. Be careful with that. Okay? The Bible tells us that believers are not to be unequally yoked with unbelievers. The New Testament instruction is in line with the Old Testament commands in earlier, even just in this own book, Judges chapter 2, verses 1 through 3, talks about there needs to be a separation here. Okay? And we also need to remember, it's like, okay, well, that's a New Testament instruction, do not be unequally yoked with an unbeliever. But our God is the God who never changes. He says, "I'm the same today, yesterday, and forever," right? Verse 5. Samson went down to Timnah with his father and mother, and it came to the vineyards of Timnah. And I don't know how much of a fight his parents put up, but after their initial protest, what do we see them doing? They're escorting him down to the enemy's camp. And I'm going to pick on, I don't think, I don't, you know, I'm going to pick on parents here. I'm assuming most of you are not parents. Maybe you, I don't know. But if you're thinking of becoming a parent, one thing to recognize, too many well-meaning parents have ushered their own kids down the road to the camp of the enemy by indulging their fantasies rather than drawing a line in the sand and saying, "No, if you're going to do it, you can do that on your own, but we are not going to support you in it." Right? And I get that. One day, your kid might say, "Well, I'm out of here, and we're done." And they'll go off into the world and break your heart. Our friends will do that same sort of things. Oftentimes, really, I've worked with a lot of students, and I've worked with a lot of permissive parents. Permissive parents are literally just trying to be a friend. And it's like, not even a good friend. They're kind of an enabling friend. And it's like, who wants a parent who is, you know, basically setting aside their own authority role to be something that it really isn't fitting for them? I'm like, thank you. No. A good friend should be able to tell you, you're being stupid, right? You need to stop this thing. My best friends have told me things that have absolutely destroyed me because they were true. And I had a choice. I'm either going to listen to it and I'm going to change, or I'm not going to listen to it and I'm going to go off and do an ungodly thing. If you really are a friend, you really are a loving friend. And if you ever are really a loving parent, you learn to say no, right? We see going ahead here in verse 5. Now, to his surprise, he's playing in the vineyards. So they're wandering down to Timnah, and he goes and he finds himself in a vineyard. What's the problem there? Yeah, don't be around the grapes. Don't be around the any fruit of the vine. And now he's kind of, oh, I'm going to play in this area. This will be fun. He's not even with mom and dad. He's just kind of off, I imagine, wandering around in the place. Now, to his surprise, a young lion came roaring against him. And the Spirit of the Lord came mightily upon him, and he tore the lion apart as one would have torn apart a young goat. I don't know if any of you have torn apart a young goat, but I'm getting the idea that it's relatively easy to do. I don't suggest that you try it to find out. But it happened in this way, though he had nothing in his hand. He just barehandedly ripped this lion apart. But notice he didn't tell his father or mother what he had done. We see a really dangerous precedent being planted here in young Samson's life. He's wandering off into the vineyards on his way to marry the wrong woman. And he finds himself in a bad spot, and it's simply because he's on the wrong path to the wrong place. But because he had started down that trail, I'm just imagining, because, you know, maybe this is, you know, does this sound kind of familiar? You ever been in that spot? I'm going down the wrong trail. I'm maybe just a little emboldened to just kind of keep going and seeing how much farther this trail goes. He's off in the vineyards, Nazarite. That's like walking through a minefield, right? And he's playing games while he's on his way to deliberate sin. And guess what? Disaster strikes. Maybe you've been there and it's like, I know I'm not supposed to be doing this, but I'm already this far. What's a little farther going to, you know, what? Lion attack. 1 Peter 5:8 says, be sober, be vigilant, because your adversary, the devil, walks about like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. The trail leading to sin has been described as a slippery slope, one that grows more treacherous with every step, just like the road down to Timnah. It's interesting to see, what did God do here? He's on his way to sin. He's being silly. He's being a goofball. And then a lion attacks. It's like, if it were me, I'd be like, well, serves him right. I guess he's going to have to, you know, get a couple scars. And that's not what God did. He didn't leave him to fend for himself. He showed up and used Samson miraculously despite his sinfulness, despite his sinful position. And sadly, we see this heart of prideful arrogance exposed early on in Samson, and it's going to be one that's going to be the downfall of him eventually. Remember, it's that sowing and reaping, right? He has a choice here. He's got two things that he could do. One, he could acknowledge God showed up and saved him. If he did that, he'd have to say, because I was in the wrong place, and I was going to the wrong place, and I was looking for the wrong person, and I was doing the wrong thing. He would have to admit this cascade of errors. Or, verse 7, then he went down and talked to the woman, and she pleased Samson well. The other choice is, he could just hide it and pretend like it didn't even happen. It would conveniently allow him to go and continue to pursue sin, and that's what he chose. He continued a wrong relationship. He really started playing fast and loose with his calling because he bought into the false assumption. And hear me, you ever say this to yourself? I must be okay because God still showed up. God used me, and that's it. It must be okay. I must be all right. Maybe more wrong and dangerous than he'd ever been up to this point in his life. In the book of Jude, verse 4, it's really descriptive of this action on Samson as an ungodly man who has turned the grace of God into a license for evil and denies our only master and Lord Jesus Christ. God's grace is not a debit card, an endless credit card that you can just keep going and swiping and, oh, it's okay. God will continue to pay for it. But that's an all too common belief for us as Christians. Verse 8, after some time when he returned to get her, he turned aside to see the carcass of the lion. Behold, a swarm of bees and honey were in the carcass of the lion. He took some of it in his hand and went along eating it. When he came to his father and mother, he gave some of it to them, and they also ate it. But he did not tell them where he'd taken the honey out of the carcass of the lion. The only thing I can think here is, ew. Right? I mean, physically, but spiritually, it's just like, this is gross. But this is the paradox that Samson is. And his life is going to become even more diverse in that paradox as we continue to read. His father went down to the woman, and Samson gave a fest there, for the young men used to do so. And it happened when they saw him that they brought 30 companions with him. What did his companions see, do you think? One person read that Samson at this point is the picture of a believer going further and further away from God. And if you were to simply look at him on the outside, you'd think, oh yeah, that's a person that's dedicated to God. The long hair, the Nazarite. But his lifestyle tells a completely different picture and a different story altogether. On the outside, he looks like a man of God. But on the inside, he's no different than a man of the world. You can wear all the Christian t-shirts you want. You can have all the Christian bumper stickers. But if you're speeding down the highway, flipping off the guy who, you know, is cutting you off or whatever, what do you think the world's going to believe? They're not going to believe all of the outward appearance. They're going to look at what your actions are doing. Verse 12, Samson said to them, let me pose a riddle to you. If you can correctly solve it and explain it to me within 7 days of the feast, I'll give you 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. But if you can't explain it to me, then you should give me 30 linen garments and 30 changes of clothes. And they said to him, pose your riddle that we may hear it. So he said to them, out of the eater came something to eat, and out of the strong came something sweet. Samson, maybe this is just my opinion, he's kind of cheaping out, because normally you have a wedding party and the groom kind of gives gifts to the wedding party. Hey, thanks for showing up. Thanks for all the help and stuff. And instead he's like, I'm going to give you a riddle, essentially, that they have absolutely no chance of being able to do. And if you get it, I'll give you a gift. But if you don't get it, and he knew that they weren't going to get it, then you have to give me gifts. It's like, that's kind of cheap, right? For 3 days, they could not explain it. But it came to pass on the seventh day that they said to Samson's wife, entice your husband that he may explain the riddle to us, or else we will burn you and your father's house with fire. Have you invited us here in order to take what is ours? Is not that so? Then Samson's wife wept on him and said, you only hate me. You don't love me. You've posed a riddle to the sons of my people, but you have not explained it to me. And he said to her, look, I haven't even explained this to my father or mother, so should I explain it to you? What a great way for a marriage to get started, right? Now, She had wept on him the 7 days while their feast lasted. And it happened on the seventh day that he told her, because she pressed him so much. Then she explained the riddle to the sons of her people. And the men of the city said to him on the seventh day before the sun went down, "What's sweeter than honey? What is stronger than a lion?" And he said to them, "If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle." I've heard wives called a lot of different things, and lots of terms of endearment that go between husbands and wives. But I don't know that heifer is going to be one that is going to float real well, right? A little bit of self-knowledge is a really good thing to have. You ever been able to say, what's your kryptonite? What is your weakness? What's the temptation, attraction, or situation that if you were exposed to it, you knew you would buckle? That it's like, I'm just weak in this area and I fold every single time. You don't have to say it. Please don't. Okay. But let me suggest to you that the thought that just went through your head when I suggested, do you know what that is? That first thought, not the second one that it's like, okay, this is one that could, no, the first one that makes you go, ugh. That's the real kryptonite that you have. If you know that about yourself, that's good self-knowledge to have. Unfortunately, Samson doesn't have that, because he puts himself in bad situations and he buckles. And he continues to buckle, and we're going to see that continue to happen. End of this chapter, it says, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily. If you had not plowed with my heifer, you would not have solved my riddle. And then he goes into hero mode, except it's not very heroic. And he went down to Ashkelon and killed 30 of their men. He took their apparel and gave the changes of clothing to those who had explained the riddle. His anger was aroused, and he went back up to his father's house. And we see here the Spirit of the Lord came on Samson again, but the catalyst for this event seems to be his anger, not really righteousness, right? The reality is he put himself there. And the bigger thing, he put his wife there. He put his wife's father there. He created a terrible situation for these people. And yeah, they're the enemy, but these are people that had no business being in Samson's way, and he's now risking their lives. She acted in a way of self-preservation, because it's like, they're going to kill me. They're going to kill my whole family. The paradox is apparent here. Yet we recognize a difficult truth when Matthew 7 tells us, not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, shall enter my kingdom of heaven, but he who does the will of my Father in heaven. Many will say to me in that day, Lord, have we not prophesied in your name, cast out demons in your name, done many wonders in your name? In verse 23 of Matthew 7, I will declare to them, I have never knew you. Depart from me, you who practice lawlessness. The Spirit of the Lord comes on Samson in spite of himself. And this is not a heroic act of a deliverer, a godly deliverer. This is really more of a petty, oversensitive act of a psychopath, really. Let's finish up here. Chapter 15, it says, after a while, in the time of the wheat harvest, it came that Samson visited his wife with a young goat. Verse 20, before I go too far, Samson, his wife was given to his companion who had been his best man. Samson leaves, and his father's like, well, we're having a wedding here, so we still need a groom. Not the greatest judgment, but that's where Samson's marriage went. After some time, the harvest, a season goes by, he's like, let me go back to my wife. He's like, oh yeah, I have a wife. Let me go back to her, into her room. But her father would not permit him. Verse 2 of chapter 15. He said, I really thought that you thoroughly hated her. Therefore, I gave her to your companion. Is not your younger sister better than she? Please take her instead. And apparently, we see that Samson's dad has a better understanding of what Samson's motivations are than Samson does. He's just like, you're kind of a person who's all about the looks. He's like, she's gone, she's taken. But her sister is even better looking than she. So appealing to this fleshly attitude of Samson's. And look at verse 3 as we start to end up here. Samson said to them, "This time I shall be blameless regarding the Philistines if I handle them." With this one statement, we really see that Samson's motivation is anything but godly. There's only one thing that really motivates Samson, and that's Samson. And he's seeking revenge because his ego is hurt. Verse 4, then Samson went up and caught 300 foxes, and he took torches. He turned the foxes tail to tail, and he put a torch between each pair of their tails. He had set the torches on fire, and he let the foxes go in the standing grain of the Philistines and burned up both the shocks and the standing grain, as well as the vineyards and the olive groves. This kind of comes across as more like a childish, maybe collegiate prank than a righteous movement of God. But he has this incredible ability to do this. This is not an easy thing. It's probably hard to catch one fox. And he does this to 300. And then he just haphazardly sets fire to their tails in this, and lets them go, and basically sits back and watches chaos happen. And the Philistines say, "Who's done this?" And they answered, "The son-in-law of the Timnite, because he has taken his wife and given her to his companion." So the Philistines came up and burned her father and her with fire. Even though they're Philistines, they were placed into this terrible position all because of one man's folly and compromise and chasing after sin. Samson's wife was put in jeopardy from her own people and then put in jeopardy by her own husband. And so she did this despicable deed and she ended up being burned alive anyway. Samson said to them, "Since you would do a thing like this, I will surely take revenge on you." And that's in verse 7. "And after that, I will cease." So he attacked them, hip and thigh, and with great slaughter. Then he went down and dwelt in the cleft of the rock of Edom. What we see going on here is more of a tit for tat. It's more of a quid pro quo. You did this to me, so I'm going to be justified in doing this back to you. You know, this time I'll be blameless regarding. That pretty much is a self-admission that I had blame in everything up to this point, but now I'm blameless. And we have to recognize when we deal with that way with sin, there's nothing that's good that's going to come out of that. His actions are heroic, but they're simply that eye for an eye attack of a vengeful madman. Hip and thigh here literally means that he tore them limb from limb. And afterward, look what he did. He dwelt in the cleft of a rock, literally a cave in Edom. He's not feeling good about what he's done. There's maybe some remorse, but I would suggest to you there's probably more fear happening here. When we don't sow righteously, this is the kind of thing that we're going to reap. You may be able to be effective and God may use you, but you're not going to feel good about it, right? So what do we take away to wrap up things here? Instead of growing as a serious man of God, Samson stunted as an immature, prideful, and petty boy. Instead of applying the call that God had for his life, he played with sinful living. Instead of a character of righteousness, he characterized carnality, what it means to be dominated by the flesh and not the spirit. Instead of having a humble dependence on the promise and the power of the spirit, he pridefully presumed that the Lord would be present with him. It'll be okay. He still is using me. It's all okay. God wouldn't. Samson should be a warning to us that way. Instead of delivering Israel from the world, he ushered the nation into further anarchy and confusion. And we see craziness ensue after Samson's life is done. A few things to wrap up. We need to recognize as Christians today, we've been born into this day and age, not by accident, but by design, right? So often we see people given enormous gifts and they're entrusted to men and women who never really get serious about them, right? Leadership is something that is desperately needed in the church today. And instead, we see people go on and become class clowns and everything's just funny with them. Nothing is ever serious and nothing serious comes out of them. Occasionally, they rise up, but to the average person, they look at them and they say, it's all just a joke with you. And they don't seem to understand what's going on, and that's really Samson in a nutshell, right? If you don't understand the purpose for why you were born and it hasn't been explained to you like it was for Samson, don't be fooled. God does have a purpose for you. He has a purpose for your life. He has a purpose for saving you. He has a purpose for you being here in this room yet tonight. Maybe you don't understand what your gifting is. That's okay. Maybe you don't think you have any gifts at all, and I would suggest that's not accurate. Okay, I assure you, like Samson's mother did, and that he has saved you for a purpose, and he's gifted you according to that purpose as well. It's okay to not know everything and not know what's going to happen in your life. You don't have to know how it's all going to play out. But if there's a lesson we can take from the life of Samson, it's like, if you sow poorly at the beginning of it, don't expect to harvest richly at the end of it, right? Are you content actively following what you know to do today while you faithfully expect his plan to unfold tomorrow? In Philippians 1:6, we see the promise that he has begun a good work and you will carry it on to the day of completion in Christ Jesus. And let me just say, what that means is he didn't make junk. When he saved you, he didn't bring you this far to leave you finishing empty-handed and disappointed in your life. Okay? What is the part of that good work that God's begun in you? What is it? What is it today? You may not have the answer to that question, but let me simply suggest to you that the part you do today is simply be faithful and be serious about it. Can we close in quick prayer here?